We're talking with Peter Davenport of the National UFO Reporting Center about his proposal to build a civilian UFO detection system. And we'll conclude that conversation in a moment. I want to also get into and hear Peter describe these new, hot off the presses UFO incidents. It's been a busy night there at his reporting center with reports coming in from Indiana, Virginia, New Jersey, and I think a couple other ones. We'll hear about those in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Peter Davenport, I know you've made this pitch to wealthy individuals, to UFO organizations, and everyone has gone, that's an interesting idea. Yeah, it would probably work. No, I'm not going to give you the money. It must be disheartening, especially when you look at SETI, which has been around for so many years, has spent millions and millions of dollars without detecting a signal at all, at least that they've told us about. And it would seem to me that there could be some money from them that would go into funding this kind of a thing.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, George. And I don't know if it's hundreds of millions or by now billions of dollars that the SETI project has spent all of other people's monies, and initially taxpayers and then later some well-heeled contributors, to try to find an intelligent signal, and they have yet to find one except for that one brief signal they encountered, I think, back in the mid-1970s. Your point is a very good one. I should probably write Seth Shostak a letter and say, hey, look, let's collaborate on this project. You've got the engineers, you've got the equipment, but they are so down on UFOs. In fact, I've talked to Seth Shostak very briefly, and it was clear that he really had very little to do, wanted very little to do with me. He didn't want to talk about my principal interest. And it's worth a try, but I would like to challenge SETI to a runoff competition, George. Which of us, them or the National UFO Reporting Center, will be able to provide clear evidence of the presence of aliens in our galaxy first? And I suspect in that runoff, if I can build the passive radar system that I've described during the first part of our program tonight, I suspect that the National UFO Reporting Center would win that competition. I think we ought to, SETI and I should bet a six-pack of our favorite malted beverage as a prize to which one of us succeeds. And every one of those people down in SETI in Menlo Park, I guess they're still based, understands the principles that I've been talking about tonight, even if all of our listeners do not. And if they haven't read my article, it's available on my website. In fact, it's been there for 8 years, George. And I have yet, in the 17 years that I've been trying to influence and convince people that we can end the debate over UFOs once and for all, unambiguously, for $750,000 for the prototype, I have yet to receive my first penny from any source to fund this. You used a word a few minutes ago, disheartening. I could not have chosen a better word to express my reaction to this situation. People seem preoccupied, they're possessed with UFO events that happened 50 and 60, 65 years ago. It's like sitting in a car racing down the highway and looking out the back window. What we should be doing is looking forward. We should be taking away from our government their heretofore monopoly in the control of information about UFOs. And the Phoenix Lights case, for example, back 15 years ago, I just did a program earlier this past week with two of the witnesses, did a dynamic job of underscoring just how profound an event that was. After the program, I calculated that the object that was hovering above Sue Watson's home, she lives about a mile south of Camelback Mountain, probably 3 miles north of Sky Harbor Airport. We did a little calculation. The object that hovered above her house was between 2.5 and 7.5 miles, statute miles in width. But back to the passive radar, I am befuddled as to how we fund this thing, get it up and running, and take out of the hands of government, wrest from their control, the information about the UFO, apparent UFO visitation of our planet. But you're right, SETI should be involved. I once offered complete partnership with MUFON to the board of directors, and they were intrigued. They were interested in it. They saw the merits of my proposal, but they declined the offer for some reason. They thought it was too expensive. They didn't want to get involved in the money end of it, I think was their final conclusion. But this is a project that is so important that all UFO organizations should be involved. And what I foresee is something the equivalent of a webcam system that draws all of the information from all of the detection stations to one website, so that any individual who wishes to know what is really going on, as opposed to what the government is telling us is going on, big difference there, of course.
Oh, yeah.
They can go right to a website and look at it with their own eyes. I was born in Missouri, the Show Me State, some 64 years ago. Very important principle for me, both through my birthright as well as through my education and my personality. People should not believe anything until they've seen the evidence or hopefully proof with their own eyes. And that's what I would like to bring to the American people. And now, because of the internet, of course, to any human being on this planet who has access to the internet, who wishes to see what is going on with regard to apparent UFO visitation of our planet.
That's the objective. We'll open up the phone lines here in a little bit at the bottom of the hour and see if any of our Coast listeners have any ideas about how to fund this thing or how to keep it going. In the meantime, a couple of questions about the National UFO Reporting Center. One being, I understand from an email you sent me that the percentage of crank calls is way, way up. I would imagine you'd get some crazy kids or teenagers or whatever goofing off. But you indicated to me in this email that it's a lot.
Yeah. And disheartening. The word disheartening comes to mind again, George. I am very disappointed in what I see at my end of the National UFO Reporting Center hotline. That number, by the way, 206-722-3000, I'd like to get it out to those people who don't already know it. It's been here for 37 and a half years, same number all that time. But this is probably the hardest thing that I have to put up with. This is not an easy job. I get email from people who want to be involved in our operations. They want to help. They're crazy. You don't want to ever in your life be a UFO investigator. It is one of the most frustrating, self-alienating processes I've ever experienced in my life. But yes, the crank calls are my greatest hurdle right now, and it's actually affecting my personality. About 5 to 7, maybe 8 years ago, I would estimate, George, that maybe 5% of the calls we took on the hotline were crank calls. Just young kids generally calling to make trouble. Today, a typical day, between 30 and 80% of the calls placed to the UFO Reporting Center hotline are not only crank calls, not only people wanting to waste my time, which is very precious to me, but screaming the most quadruple X-rated filth you've ever heard in your life. What has happened to the American people? It's bizarre. I mean, young kids, not only young kids, preteens, boys and girls, I can't call them men and women at that age, calling here and shouting filth.
Can you tell the
part, sexual function, you name it.
Can you tell where the calls are coming from? Do you have a... And is it all the same people calling over and over? Or is it from all over the country?
Oftentimes, I had one lad from Tacoma, Washington, call on his cell phone 49 times in 48 minutes. Now, there are some people who are just mentally ill. You got to give them some slack. They don't know what they're doing. They're out of control. There's one guy in St. Paul who's called here hundreds and hundreds of times. And I was recently in touch with a Minnesota court. They had this case against him brought by the FBI and by the Bloomington, Minnesota Police Department, I'm led to believe, and they couldn't do anything. He's mentally ill. So the court just threw the case out of the court. But my message to the American parents who have young kids who have cell phones is you had better watch them. You had better supervise them. What I would call for, I've ruminated on this at great length, George, trying to figure out a way to stop it. I've even considered putting their numbers on our website and having listeners to radio programs call them over and over and over again so they get a taste of their own medicine.
There you go. Hey, we'll volunteer some help on that.
But I really don't want to go down that path. It could backfire. I'm not even sure it's legal. What they're doing, I believe, is not legal, but I could spend my whole day 10 times over trying to combat this kind of stupidity. But my message to parents is don't just give a cell phone to your child and expect that child is going to behave himself or herself. I mean, that's tantamount to rebuilding a fancy Lamborghini and tossing the keys to your 16-year-old son or daughter who just got his driver's license. That is a formula for disaster, and that's what people have done with their children with these texting devices and telephones. The social impact, the social effect of all of this electronics in the hands of young kids who cannot exercise good judgment is yet to be determined. But I think in the future, we will rue the day that we gave all of this horsepower, this electronics, to these young kids without supervision. When you and I were growing up, the only telephone we had in our house was in the hallway within earshot of everybody in the house. But that's no longer the case. Kids go to the malls, they've got these phones, they go up in tree houses, and they can just raise any kind of mischief they wish. I think American parents should be supervising their children and insisting that they keep a record of every call they make or receive. That is the only solution to this. And I've made this proposal before, and people say, horrors, that couldn't possibly be done. Well, it used to be done by all ham radio operators in this country. Every time you made a contact, you were required under the rules of ham radio to record that call. And that's what I think should be done with these young kids until they've proven their mettle, until they've proven that they can behave themselves and handle it responsibly. But this is what I'm putting up with at this end of the hotline is just unbelievable, George. What has happened to us?
Well, it's not only phone calls. It's manifests itself in a lot of other ways as well. We got about 5 minutes before we go to the bottom of the hour, and I'm going to open up the phone lines a little bit. But can you give us a thumbnail sketch of some of these UFO cases that have come in the last 24 hours?
Yeah.
Good stuff?
Good stuff. This has been a very busy night. For example, the case I was alluding to earlier in the program from Verona, New Jersey, a young couple out hiking, apparently in the dark, in a, I think, some kind of park. I don't know if it's state or local park. And they looked up and were flabbergasted to see a fireball, a round fireball. It appeared to them to be totally spherical, like a basketball or a soccer ball, just very slowly moving its way over the tops of the trees. The reason I found that so very interesting is I had just taken a call from a couple in, I believe, Barboursville, West Virginia. I may have the city wrong. I'm awaiting the written report. But they saw something very similar. Reports from Wisconsin, two reports from the state of Oregon, a gentleman in Newburgh, Oregon, this evening, I think it was about 10 o'clock, so just a few hours ago, was outside, and he saw a spherical ball of light going to the west. The direction of the object is significant because satellites, as you no doubt know, almost never course to the west. They're always going east. They always have an easterly component to their ground track, or they're in polar orbit from North Pole to South Pole and so on. So this report from Newburgh, we are awaiting. And interestingly, the second report from Albany, Oregon, I was just talking to a cousin in Albany, Oregon, and not 30 minutes later, a phone call came in from a gentleman who this morning, about 1:20 a.m., again, this is Sunday morning, the 18th of March, today, he saw a cluster of white objects in a triangular formation. His father saw the same thing, and his son, who was two blocks away, saw the same thing that the father and grandfather were looking at. So we'll be able to triangulate and calculate or do a rough estimate as to how far away this object was from them. Once we know that information, we can estimate its size, estimate velocity, and so on and so forth. But these people, I wish I could share some of the audio clips with our audience. Maybe we can do that at a future program. But they were flabbergasted. People who've never seen a UFO before are seeing them on a regular basis now, and something is taking place. My instincts, again, are suggesting to me that this phenomenon is rapidly coming to a head. If people want to see a very interesting photo on the homepage of UFOcenter.com, there's a very interesting photo taken by a gentleman who had 14,000 hours in aircraft. Not only is he a professional pilot, a commercial pilot, but he's an A&P IA mechanic. And he was flying on the 16th of September last year. He was flying from Seattle, where he'd been at an exhibit, that back down to Los Angeles, where he's based, or San Diego. There were five qualified pilots aboard his Grumman, Albatross. And you can see the photograph that this pilot captured out the starboard side of his aircraft as they were flying over Oregon. I don't mean to pick on Oregon tonight, George, but these three cases have just come to mind. He caught a photograph of something nobody but nobody can figure out what it was. I can't certify that it's a genuine, bona fide alien spacecraft, but nobody that I've talked to has been able to figure out what it is. Even the U.S. Navy down in San Diego has expressed keen interest. A bunch of F-18 guys have expressed keen interest in that photo. They can't figure it out either. So a lot of material is coming to us. We're trying to get it to our website as fast as we possibly can, not nearly fast enough to satisfy me or many people who complain about it, but that's what's going on, and that underscores why I'm so terribly grateful to you and to Coast to Coast to allow me to come on from time to time to share this information with listeners who may have an interest in this subject.
Oh, it's our pleasure. I'm curious, you talked about the lack of financing for the larger project. How is it that you were able to stay afloat?
I don't know, George. Virtually every penny of my expenses come out of my own pocket. Now, because of Mr. Bernanke and the Federal Reserve System, my investment or retirement account is down to almost zero, so it's coming out of my savings account now. It's about $500 a month that it cost me to run this operation. On top of that, I work two shifts a day, 7 days a week, to make sure that the American people have a place where they can report their UFO sightings. But that's how it's run. In the past, a few people have been very generous and kicking a few bucks our way, but that is a thumbnail sketch of how the National UFO Reporting Center keeps itself afloat and pays its bills.
Well, maybe we can come up with some ideas, sir, for helping just the operation of that, if not the funding of the larger project that you have in mind. I mean, it seems like there should be a way to keep that going. A lot of the UFO organizations around the country and around the world certainly make use of your material.
Yeah, they sure do. The problem is trying to charge them for it.
Yeah.
And that's the difficulty. How do you charge somebody $5 for a case? It costs you more time and more frustration to send out the bill than it's worth.
Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll guilt them into it, Peter. Peter Davenport is my guest. We're opening up the phone lines with your questions for him about the National UFO Reporting Center or his proposal for a UFO detection system or anything else. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Peter Davenport. We've opened up the phone lines, and we'll be going to your calls and questions. Already a lot of ideas pouring in that Peter will be happy to hear about, ideas for how to raise money both for the UFO detection system and to keep his operation going. Coast to Coast listeners coming through with some pretty creative ideas already. We'll go back to the phone lines and see what's on your mind with questions for my guest, Peter Davenport, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Peter Davenport, you'll be happy to know that a lot of emails coming in with people who would like to contribute to help keep your operation going, other ideas for how to raise some money on a larger scale. So I'll be forwarding these to you. In the meantime, we'll go to the phone lines. First time caller, Raymond in Michigan. Hi, Raymond.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Knapp, Mr. Davenport. It's a pleasure speaking with you this morning.
Good. Thank you for calling, Raymond.
Hi, thank you. I just have a question of a an email that I receive. I receive emails from like NASA. They have their little program that they send different emails out different times of the weekend. They said that last Monday, their telescopes observing the sun, they seen a UFO pull up to the edge of the sun and extended the cable out, extracting, I guess, some type of energy from the sun. I was wondering if you have heard of that or be able to comment on that, Mr. Yep. Davenport.
Well, I haven't heard that information, but I'm usually prepared to comment on any subject. In fact, hosts usually have a problem trying to shut me up, so I'll give you my best shot at it, Raymond. I would be very surprised if, in fact, that was a UFO. A lot of people, including NASA and their instrumentation, photograph the moon, and it can generate optical aberration. Now, I don't know what happened in the circumstance that you described, but I'd be very surprised if a UFO can pull up next to the sun because it's pretty hot, and they'd need one hell of a an air conditioning unit to keep it at a moderate temperature on the inside of the craft, as far as I know. I have not heard that story. If you'd like to send me a link to my email address, I'd be happy to take a look at it, and I will respond to you via email if you can send me an email address, please.
Okay,
thanks, Ray.
I will do that. Thank you very much for your comment.
Thanks for the call.
Peter, have you seen any of these videos online? I get sent a copy of it, it seems like, once a week of people who think that they've detected craft across the face of the sun.
Yeah. I can't say, I'm not qualified, George, to really comment intelligently or professionally, but I get many, many, many photographs in the course of a week or a month or certainly a year. And my estimate, and I'm going to be modest and conservative here, my estimate is that 99, perhaps even 99.9% of the photographs and videos that are sent to the National UFO Reporting Center are probably not of UFOs, of genuine alien spacecraft. Now, I can't say definitively that that's the case because so many of them they're blurry, they catch things in motion, and what are they? I have no idea. There's no amount of computer power that would allow a person to reconstruct what that object was from a blurry photograph. You just can't do it. And so most of the photos we receive are, at best, the most polite thing I can say is ambiguous. People send us, for example, George, it's incredible what human beings do. I should write a book, not on UFOs, but the incredible human behavior and human psychology that I have seen in the course of the last 17 years as director of the National UFO Reporting Center. But it gets even worse when the photo makes its way into the press, I've discovered. I don't know how many times, when I lived in Seattle, how many times I was called by news media to rush downtown to look at this photograph of a UFO that had just been submitted to them, and they needed a professional's opinion on the matter. I'd race down there, I'd spend the parking and the gas, and I'd go in and I'd look at what they have on a screen in their studios for about 2 to 5 seconds, and almost invariably what they were looking at was contrails behind high-flying aircraft. If it was taken during the evening in the western sky that was reflecting the setting sun, or if it was taken in the morning, the rising sun in the east. And so it's very, very difficult to get good, high-quality photographs. I think in the 17 years I've been doing this job, George, I've probably received maybe 6 really good photographs. videos, and I often use them during public presentations.
Well, the fact is, it's an important work to identify the ones that can be identified as prosaic explanations. You need to weed them out. That's really important for the credibility of the whole field.
Yeah, absolutely. And people are much, much more willing to accept photographs as being evidence of honest-to-golly UFOs. I've made a lot of enemies because I would not accept their proposition that the photograph they had was unambiguously of an alien spacecraft. And before I forget it, some of those photos I will play probably in McMinnville, Oregon, second weekend in May. We're having the 13th annual McMinniman's Festival, the second weekend in May. Anybody who lives in the Pacific Northwest, that is a conference that they should not miss. It's really a delightful conference. And I was at the, I could say the same thing about the Arkansas conference, which takes place next month, I believe, in Northwest Arkansas. People who live anywhere close to Arkansas or Missouri should seriously consider going to those conferences because they're both really well run. They call in some of the best speakers, and they're really a delight to attend.
Well, McMinnville, you were talking about the limited number of legitimate UFO photographs. The McMinnville case would have to qualify as one of them, the analysis.
Right. You're exactly correct, George.
Way back when, yeah.
Yep, May 11th, 1950, the photo that made Life magazine. It's celebrated in McMinnville, Oregon, and that's the reason for the conference. They kicked it off in the year 2000. They had Dr. Bruce Maccabee come. He was the first speaker in this series. And because of his expertise as a photo analyst, he has a PhD, of course. He worked for the Navy, I believe, in the field of photography. He first presentation at that festival was Bruce Maccabee talking about the authenticity of the Trent family photographs, and they are convincing.
East of the Rockies, Robert in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Hi, Robert.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Okay.
I'm a big fan of your work. I look forward to seeing you on the show.
Thanks.
Mr. Davenport, I had a suggestion for you. I really admire your work, and I was wondering, I know Dan Aykroyd's a big supporter of MUFON and the UFOs and everything. Have you thought about going to him maybe for like a donation?
Well, that's a very good recommendation. He's spoken in Seattle. I think he's aware of our center. And there are many, 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 many things that I should be doing, but I have just 24 hours in my day. And with the telephone ringing off the hook and with reports pouring in over the internet, I don't have the latitude, the opportunity to do everything I feel I would like to be doing and should be doing. I've heard many recommendations as to what I should be doing over the last 17 and a half years. If people would like to help with the finances of this center or with financing the construction of a passive radar system, I'd invite them just to get in touch with me. I don't have the time to go out and reach out to many people in my present circumstance, but thank you, Robert, for the very good suggestion. I will consider that. I know people in Seattle who have access. They have a conduit to him, and we'll see what he might be willing to do.
Thanks, Robert. Appreciate it. Wildcard line, Steve in Dallas. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Davenport, a couple of things that you probably could do. I have family that work in the phone industry. And I know that if you have caller ID, you will have a log of the calls that have been made to you. And certainly you can report those calls that have come to you where people are basically harassing you.
Yeah.
And they will take action. They are legally bound to.
Well,
and another thing that you could possibly do to raise money is set up a number where the Coast listeners or anybody else could, if they text a certain number to you, that they would donate $1 or $2 or something along those lines. And that's the way like Red Cross and other organizations have used that to raise money for their organization.
That's a good
and
suggestion.
There's 20 million Coast listeners, so maybe you could get a little bit of money.
Yep, that's a very good recommendation. I will look into it.
With regard to your first comment, Steve, I have for years tried to get the telephone company to help me on this prank call. What happens is this, invariably, and I've been through this routine dozens of times. You call the phone company, you describe the situation, and they say, no, 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 no. That's not our responsibility. You call law enforcement. And you call law enforcement and explain the situation, and they say, oh, no, 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 no. You want to talk to the telephone company. And back and forth and back and forth. Very, very, very few people on this planet want to take responsibility for what's going on and will take a hard position and try to solve somebody else's problem. So your recommendation may be a good one. I don't know all of the law pertaining to telephone, but I've gone down that route. I couldn't tell you how many times, and the telephone companies don't want to hear it. It's that simple.
Thank you, Steve. Joe in Lynn, Massachusetts on the Wild Card Line. Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. Peter, it's been a privilege to hear you. I miss you. You used to hear you a lot on the years. I just wanted to a couple things. Say, yeah. If I can ever help, I will. I'm visually impaired and wanted to thank you. I know you've been through hell.
Yeah, some days I have.
Did you move into your new place yet, the silo that George talked about? I'd like you to describe that sometime. I'm really interested.
No, I haven't, and that's a good question. I should have mentioned that earlier. 6 years ago this month,
yes,
I purchased a decommissioned U.S. Air Force ICBM missile site.
What a place to live.
Oh, boy. But after I purchased, my intent was to live in it, set up the hotline in it, and just have a neat residence. But the problem...
Did it have all the generators? I mean, everything was gone, but did it have the air filters?
No, it was thoroughly salvaged before I ever bought it.
Oh, boy.
But it still has 3 million tons of cement and rebar. It is a prodigious structure. But the problem is it's going to take a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of cleanup to get it to a state where a person would be comfortable living out there. And actually, I discovered after I purchased it that I am much more socially inclined than I thought was the case.
You're still back in Washington or Seattle?
Yeah, it's in Washington.
Oh, but I mean, you're still back at your old place where you were?
No, I'm in eastern Washington, as I mentioned earlier in the program. I'm about 50 miles west of Spokane out in the wheat country, close to the missile site. But I just haven't moved into it because it's a bit lonely. And I don't have a family. I don't have a wife and kids, so I'd be out there all by myself with the wolves and the cougars and the badgers and the aliens. And I could dump $1 million or $2 million in it if I had it, and then I'd have a one-bedroom bachelor pad. So plans have changed a little bit since I purchased it, but it's sort of a nifty place to own, and I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but we have a photograph of it on our homepage, as you probably noted.
Can I ask?
Well, thanks. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's an honest mistake. If I can ever help, Peter, and if you have any DVDs, I know I spoke with you a long time ago. I don't have a good family either. I'm visually impaired. I've tried my best. Things just haven't worked out. I will. But do you have that radar thingy on the website, that page?
On our homepage. You can read over on the left-hand side of our homepage. Scroll down until you see passive radar. Have somebody read it to you if you can't read it off a screen yourself. And it's been there for 8 years. I've made the same pitch for the last 17 years. Started in January of 1995. In fact, if we have a little time, George, either this program or maybe a future one, I'll share with our listeners just how I came up with this idea and what prompted me to realize that we could use passive radar to detect UFOs.
Well, we'll save that for a future program because I'm sure we'll have you back. Try to get a couple of more calls in. Sue in Dyer, Indiana. Good morning, Sue.
Good morning. Hi, George. You're one of my favorite MCs. Actually, I enjoy it when you're on.
Thank you.
Also, Peter, I'd like to thank you for all of your hard work and dedication. I think that speaks loudly as to who you are. And without guys like you, the rest of us wouldn't have much.
Well, thank you very much for the kind words.
No problem.
We ufologists live on a steady diet of ridicule, skepticism, out-and-out hatred, and threats to our lives. And you have no idea how far a few kind words would go or do go in this field. So It brings tears to my eyes to receive a compliment like that. We do work hard up here.
Oh, you bet. I know that you do. I've organized big events and things in my life, and I know how much goes into it. But yours has been years after year after year, and mine has not, and thank God. So well, if you have the strength and energy, then obviously God or somebody's backing you up, because I practically collapsed. But I called in part. I wanted to tell you a couple quick stories, and I'll be very brief.
It better be brief, because we got 2 minutes left, Sue.
They are. I saw a comet one time in the backyard walking the dogs with my husband. It was very low to the ground. It was orange with a purple tail, and I wondered if it's important to report that kind of thing as like a UFO.
Every report, and that brings me to a concluding comment I'm going to present here briefly. I estimate that out of 20,000 adult, competent, clear-thinking Americans with good vision who see UFOs, only one of them ever writes it down. And my appeal to all the Coast to Coast listeners is, if you have ever at any time seen what you think, sincerely think, was a UFO, a bona fide UFO, I would be most grateful if you would write it down. Not call me. Write it down. Everybody wants to talk and talk and talk and talk, and they'll talk forever about their UFO sighting. That doesn't do any good. It's like racing the engine of your powerful pickup at a red traffic signal. What I would like people to do, again, if they've ever seen a UFO, is write it down and submit a report using the online report form on our website, ufocenter.com. Takes 5 minutes to do. We will post your report, and we will let people know about your sighting.
Sue, thanks for that call. How many do you get a day, Peter? Written reports?
Yeah, somewhere between 5 and 50 a day, George. It's highly variable, and I don't understand why. But I would say on average, but we post between 10 and 30 reports per day. We've had, I think, about 30 reports just today. It's been a very busy day.
And is it building to something? I mean, is there any long-term trend, or is it just it's peaks and valleys?
It's hard for me to say, but these reports we've gotten of red, orange, and yellow fireballs are pouring in here. It's been the case for the last 9 months. I do not know what these things are, George. And my appeal to the Coast listeners is, if you have ever seen any of these fireballs, individuals or clusters, red, orange, yellow is their traditional colors, please don't just think about it, don't just talk about it, but actually write it down, even if it's just a short paragraph, and submit it as a report. That information could be crucially important for trying to figure out what's going on this planet.
Peter Davenport, thanks so much for joining us. I'll be sending you a lot of emails that have come my way with ideas from Coast to Coast listeners. Best of luck to you. Thanks also to my earlier guests, Jerry Reynoldson and Craig Downer, talking about wild horses, and to my friends there and colleagues at Premier, Nathan and Will and Lex, for helping us tonight with this program. Good night, everyone. I'll be back next Friday filling in for George Norrie, and as well as next Sunday night. Hope you'll be tuning in then. See you later.